until the day break and the shadows flee away, be thou like a roe or a young hart.
Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula Gordon. Did our music surprise you? It's part of Song of Songs, an environmental composition by sound activist and composer Barry Truex. Barry's concerned that today's synthesized, mass-produced, oversimplified sounds are making us numb. He thinks that we should enrich our hearing.
To me, it's a regaining of complexity, that these are complex situations, multi-leveled, including the symbolic level. For me, virtual reality is not just, you know, pretending that you're in some imaginary space. It's also the world of the imaginary. The imaginary is the virtual realm for us. Symbolism, metaphor, all of these things that are very important in make us human, really.
Sound is a whole universe most of us seldom explore. It affects our health and who we are. So Bill Russell and I went to Vancouver to visit Barry because Barry cares passionately about sound. He teaches acoustic communication at Simon Fraser University. He composes and he works tirelessly to make our soundscape more human-friendly. That's important because sound is fundamental to who we are. Researchers agree sounds are our first and last experiences of life. When we come back, meet Barry Truex. Stay tuned to The Paula Gordon Show. Barry Truex, I have it on very good authority that the first sense that a human embryo has is that of sound. And often the very last sense to go as we die is sound. Well, if it is so big that it encompasses our beginnings and our ends, shouldn't we be thinking about sound during our lives as well?
Well, not just thinking about it. The thinking, I think, comes later. I think we should be listening to it first. Because you're right, it surrounds us. It also surrounds us 24 hours a day. There are no ear lids, as Murray Schafer has commented.
Great
on.
Great line.
Yeah,
no ear
exactly.
Lids.
He was particularly good at those kind of lines.
Well, don't we have sort of the problem of the fish that doesn't know about water because they're surrounded with it? Mm-hmm. Why, so there's yeah. Sound, okay.
And that's one reason why, for instance, one of our first exercises we give our students in our beginning acoustic communication class is a pair of earplugs, because they are always surrounded by sound, and often a sound that oppresses them.
And oppresses?
Oppresses them, definitely noise. Uh-huh. Let's call it what it is. Uh-huh. It's an oppressive stress on the body and the mind. And so we give them a pair of earplugs, which seems odd in a sensitivity class, but that's exactly the reason. Because they've taken all this for granted. They've adapted to it. They've never thought about it. It's just simply they're bathed in it, and in some cases retreating from it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the earplugs give them, first of all, an option. They have now, instead of flight or fight, they can also insert.
Yes, and, yes.
Exactly. And they will then, the sounds, they often feel very isolated and a little fearful at the beginning because they think they're missing something or the things that they took for granted. Now they'll realize, yes, they really were dependent on those things. And then the little kicker at the end, the punchline is when you take them out, you have an artificially lower threshold shift. Mm-hmm. It's like being in a dark room and then coming out into a bright one, except not quite as painful.
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly everything is like super hi-fi and super dynamic range until you readapt again. And so suddenly the world is all whatever the oral equivalent of Technicolor would be.
What, I'm curious, what kind of sounds are you talking about? There's so much in the middle of it.
Everything, including, of course, how technology mediates. You see, most people don't realize how much various kinds of technology, either the 19th century mechanical kind or now the 20th century electronic digital kind, totally permeate and our soundscape, if I could start to use that word.
Mm-hmm.
Here.
Sure. You're talking about traffic?
Absolutely.
Radio, music,
everything.
People talking.
Air conditioning.
What we have control over and what we don't have control over.
Mm-hmm.
What we have control over and we also introduce into our lives. There's also, we always think, oh, it's them, it's all that traffic, that nasty stuff out there. And then we tend to isolate ourselves from it. And then we replace, one of the theories that I'll put forward is the surrogate idea of media. Media as an accompaniment, as a surrogate environment that we accompany ourselves with. So if you can't do anything about the traffic, you put on a Walkman. If you can't stand the sound of your neighbors, well, you put on the radio and the hi-fi. And it also, mirroring the fetus, is first thing in the morning and often last thing at night.
Mm-hmm.
It is part of the comforting bracketing of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying, don't get me wrong, I'm not against anyone's, quote, lifestyle choices here. Because, no, they're really not personal attacks on anybody. I really don't care what people listen to or choose to listen to or not to listen to. I'm more concerned about what the implications are if they do cut themselves off from the world, because technology is always put forward to us in the unabashed hype. It's positive only. It's, you know, but in fact, there's a balance sheet going on. You gain something, but you lose something. And so the industry wants us to realize the gains, but we're often not thinking, okay, what am I losing by doing this?
Well, I think also that just the fact that there is a choice, most of us don't think about
that. Don't think about it.
You know, we just sort of default into it.
Right.
What you're describing sounds like the restaurant in which, you know, it starts out real quiet.
That's right.
And then people come in and the noise level goes up and you talk louder so you can be heard and the noise level goes up. And before the end of the evening, everyone's yelling at one another, which tends to generate tension.
That's right. And then they wonder why you go home feeling totally exhausted, if not, you know,
for having gone out to dinner,
beaten up or whatever, you know, orally or something like that.
It's also worth saying there was a time when we lived in the midst of sound, but they were the sounds generated by nature.
That's right.
And for all that, sometimes on vacation you go listen to the birds sing or whatever.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky, yeah. But that is a major shift in the experience of the species and in the industrialized and post-industrial, if you will, nations. So there's a spectrum in what is available in natural sounds. And isn't there a concern among the community in which you work about not losing some of those natural sounds?
Exactly. But also keeping the human scale, because, you know,
what does that mean?
We don't exactly. That's what I think is very important here, because we can tend to romanticize and idealize the natural soundscape, which is disappearing, of course, unfortunately. But we can still learn from those natural ecosystems, because they are also good examples of acoustic ecology, not just biological ecology, the balance of those. But it was very important in the work of the World Soundscape Project, after they had done the Vancouver soundscape first, their own home city, and discovered all the noise problems and how in its rather short history it had changed from the natural keynote sounds of water and wind and the seagulls, etc.
Keynote.
It's a musical term. It's sort of the reference to which other things come. The sounds that are always there. Again, this is
seagull,
classic.
Seashore.
Yes, and now air conditioning and electrical hums, right?
Uh-huh.
These are the keynotes. Because they're ignored. This is, again, Schaeffer's terminology from the soundscape.
Schaeffer is?
R. Murray Schaeffer, the Canadian composer who founded the World Soundscape Project.
Thank you.
And so in his book, such as The Tuning of the World, which is still extremely inspirational along these lines, he's talking about exactly that, how the soundscape has changed, how its keynotes, the references, the background, if you will, against which all foreground elements appear, how those things have changed, and now we're in a technologically mediated environment most of the time. So to get back to the human scale, we tended to think, first of all, when we started recording natural environments, of course, oh, what a wonderfully naturally balanced ecology. But then when they went to Europe and studied some smaller villages, they realized that the traditional small-scale village was full of sounds, particularly the Italian one, of course. Voices all over the place. Oh, absolutely. Mamma mia. You know, et cetera, et cetera. And it was on a human vocal scale.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and even technically, that's in the 60 decibel range. There's no possibility of hearing loss in that age, in that range. Communication is very open. It's not stressful. Basically, nothing bad happens in that range. And we judge more or less everything, as we do in many things, by what is human scale or not. And the little aphorism the Soundscape Project had was, if you can hear the sounds of your footsteps in an environment, you're in a hi-fi environment.
Hmm.
In other words, you're not cut off from your basic contact with the environment. And as soon as your personal space or oral space is less than that, you can't even hear the sounds of your footsteps, let alone conversing with each other, then clearly you're not in a human scale environment. And that was called a lo-fi environment.
I'm curious, as you say, human scale, because I find increasingly that I find myself thinking, well, humans are good. We need to pay attention to humans. But what if the bonobos, the chimpanzees, here in a different place? Mm-hmm. What if we're hurting other parts of the biosphere with the noise we're generating? And it may not hurt my ears, mm-hmm. but it may be real hard on other creatures. Is anybody thinking about the overall effect? Well, I'll tell you exactly my example. Mm-hmm. I remember reading that with the ozone layer going away, that people can wear hats, but what happens to the plants? Mm-hmm. What happens to the other animals yes. who are exposed to an entirely new ecological environment? And I came to you with the idea of that was introduced by you in a something called Science News, that was the audio ecology, which was a brand new idea to me.
Acoustic ecology, yes, I'd prefer to say. Now, a branch of that, an important branch of that that I'm not personally involved with, is bioacoustics and the effect of sound on habitat. Mm-hmm. But I could refer you to the work of, say, Bernie Krause.
So there are people others. Doing this thinking.
There are, yes. And they have objected to, for instance, in the crisis situation, in the crisis sense of these explosions that they were going to do underwater to test various things and for scientific purposes and how they would affect the dolphins and whales, for instance. But Krause points to what he calls a niche hypothesis, that habitat is not just physical, but it can also be the oral habitat, and that there are certain frequencies, you might say, that the species transmit on, so to speak, mm-hmm. and that if those get covered up by other sounds in that area, then they no longer have that oral space for communication, right? It's like we're imposing on their bandwidth. Now, that's just a hypothesis, but he has rather, convincing data to suggest that's worth looking into. It's just mm-hmm. difficult for us to know what's important in those bioacoustic patterns. I tend to treat it the other way. I find that there's more than enough to do with just simply the human scale of communication that I constantly, though, encourage people in our technological mediated environment, which I'm just as involved in, as you will hear,
and maybe more.
Probably more in my creative sense, but to constantly go back to the acoustic world as a source of inspiration and delight and knowledge and wisdom even.
That, in the context of noise, mm-hmm. of which you were speaking, is mm-hmm. no small feat.
Yes, that's right. And, of course, remember, noise has been with us. The earliest Western written down legend, that of Gilgamesh, 3rd millennium B.C., is that the gods let loose the deluge that destroyed the first city, Uruk, because, quote, they couldn't sleep because of the noise of mankind. So the first time that people got together in cities. Now, Schaefer commented, Riley, it was the only effective form of noise abatement ever invented, the flood. In Vancouver here, some 5 millennia later, I've been on the Vancouver's Urban Noise Task Force, where we're trying to do something more constructive than a flood, although I'm sure people have been exasperated to the point where they wouldn't mind their neighbors or whoever being drowned a little bit. However, we have to deal, as soon as people get together in any density, then, of course, the infringement of acoustic spaces becomes difficult. And do you use a democratic model, or are you going to protect the minorities, those who are more sensitive?
We now have many things to come back to in just a moment.
That's right.
We are in Vancouver with Barry Truax, who is both a professor at Simon Fraser University, and an electroacoustic composer. See, if I say it slowly, I get all the way through it. Bill Russell is here. We're with Barry Truax. Please stay with us. I'm Paula Gordon, and this is The Paula Gordon Show. Welcome back to The Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula Gordon. Bill Russell is here. We are in Vancouver, British Columbia, with Barry Truax, who is a professor. Let's see if I can get this right. A professor at Simon Fraser. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's an S. Simon mm-hmm. Fraser University, where you do a lot of work around all kinds of communication issues mm-hmm. that are sound-related.
Mm-hmm.
Bill wants to talk. I can see it coming.
You mentioned the work you do here in Vancouver, you know, and I think my guess is that in the world at large, not many people have heard of acoustic ecology, and it's not a meaningful concept. And even after they've heard of it, there's sort of a so what. And I think it might help if you just talked a little bit, tell us a little bit about what you're doing in Vancouver acoustically.
Yes. It did start here. The World Soundscape Project did start here, and it has a 25 or 30-year history. But in 1993, at a conference in Banff, Alberta, celebrating, called The Tuning of the World, after Schaefer's book and celebrating his 60th birthday.
The Tuning of the World. Isn't that lovely?
Great title, and it still is a very inspirational book. It has been out of print, but now it's back, and I think people could find it. Although I think now there's a version called The Soundscape, or The New Soundscape. And then it was followed up by my book, Acoustic Communication, that we can talk about. Anyway, in 1993 at the Tuning of the World Conference, a spontaneous organization was formed, or an organization was formed spontaneously by the 300 participants from around the world, called the World Forum for Acoustic Ecology, WFAE.
And it has a website.
And it has a website based in Oregon, for what it's worth. But it's and now the newsletter, which was published here in Vancouver with Hildegard Westerkamp, after 12 issues, has now moved to Switzerland, where it's being published and distributed. And you can become a member, receive the newsletter, and even if not, you can get on the Acoustic Ecology listserv and visit the website for, how do they say it, a site for ear-minded people.
That's wonderful. A site for ear-minded people.
Yes, well, you see, we don't have the wealth of visual metaphors, you know, that others do, you know.
Yeah, but it's so much more attention-getting because we don't.
So we pervert the, you know, eyewitnesses become ear witnesses and landscape becomes soundscape, and we have this little shared jargon. This is also to remind us that language is important in shaping, and I have heard, you know, people just blithely say, oh, 80% of learning in schools is visual, right?
And the answer is wrong.
What is language? Where is language in that? Is it really only 20%? And why, in our mediated communication now via computers and email and everything else, do we think we can get along without sound? And notice the problems that happen. Like email is a great example. Without the sound and the interpersonal inflection of the voice, you can't tell whether people are serious. They always come across as much more aggressive and hard-edged because nothing mediates it. The form of the communication, the sound. You know, we should be teaching listening skills. Of course, there are educators, but they feel they're fighting a losing battle as well, that we teach the reading and the writing and the arithmetic, but what about listening skills? And it can't start too soon because it's an attitude towards the world. And if you believe someone like Berendt, Joachim Ernst Berendt, who talks about the sound that the fetus is bathed in, etc., in his book, The Third Ear, then, in fact, he even claims that the oral sensitivity is something that basically the world needs because it is a harmonizing type of openness, and it's not as much oriented towards the type of tension and aggression. Now, that needs to be followed up, but it points in a certain direction that ear-minded people have just simply a different way of understanding the world and being in the world.
Doesn't that go, to go back to Vancouver and what you're doing here, isn't that part of what you're trying to do, is establish an environment where
people... What is it you're trying to do?
Well, it is not...
to do with sound.
It's not prohibitive, though. I mean, you're not just looking at prohibition, which tends to be the way we look at sound as a problem
to be fixed
and to deal with noise.
That's right. And generally, the noise is a good term for when you're talking about the negative effects, which people should be careful about, because a lot of people say, oh, it doesn't affect me and I can get used to it. But that only means they're habituated to it, and there are many involuntary reactions, blood pressure it being one, and sleep disturbance being another,
that's
that affects
way
you whether you like it or not, or adapt to it or not.
And that's way before you have hearing damage, because hearing damage is not trivial in this subject either.
That's right, and hearing damage is, of course, and with our young people, it becomes almost an ethical issue. Are we educating them to the risks, or are we just putting them down as to, oh, you're ruining your hearing with that music? And they know we're not concerned about the sound, it's the music that they think we don't like. But that's the noise is very important. important to understand the risks, but to balance that, to understand the positive aspects. And I find a good analogy with health. Health is not just the absence of disease.
Mm-hmm.
It is more, you have to know what it is you're trying to preserve and what are the positive aspects. And then if people understand the positive aspects, perhaps they won't throw them away mm-hmm. needlessly.
What are we trying to preserve?
Which is the soundscape, which is the beauty and usefulness of sound in our environment. It is a way of keeping in touch with our environment, a way of interacting with the environment, of informing ourselves, of communicating with our environment. It is something that involves us as opposed to detaches us, right? And even when it is mediated, as even this conversation will probably be heard more in a mediated way, it still establishes a direct link. And many people have thought that also the voice, which would relinquish at our peril, it shows the interior of the object. If you want to know what an object is, you knock it, you hit it. You just don't look at the outside. Outsides are deceiving. Visual appearances are deceiving. But the interiority of, as Walter Ong calls it, the interiority of sound, it reflects the whole person.
Mm-hmm.
And so unless I'm a skilled actor, I'm not going to be able to project anything other than who I am. And the more you know me, you will understand, oh, he's feeling a little tense today, he's feeling good today, he's happy today. We get all this up through nonverbal aspects of language. And we are ready to, you know, abandon those with computers and other types of things, or to stylize them into tight media packages where you don't really hear stories, you don't really hear voices, you hear sound bites. Right, and you hear stage voices.
That's
you hear the
an astonishing loss of
right.
which you are speaking, isn't it?
It's potentially yes. And if someone, if the ear-minded people, if the orally sensitive minority, and it is a minority, generally probably less than 20%. If we don't listen to them now, sometimes of course they're whining because they're really in pain.
How unpleasant.
Well, yes, but and what I'm saying is it's easy to marginalize those people.
Uh-huh.
The person says, "Oh, those sirens are driving me crazy. They go by my thing, and my life is a nervous wreck." And we say, "Oh, that person is sensitive. They're a whiner. They're a complainer. Mm-hmm. I can get used to it. What's wrong with them?" Right? It's hard when you're confronted with that to realize the reason why they are in that kind of pain is valid.
Mm-hmm.
And even our medical abilities to interpret it may be lacking here. But they're also an early warning sign. Mm-hmm. If they're responding, it's going to get to us. Or to our kids,
early
or
warning
to
system.
Our, in a way.
Mm.
All right. The oral minority, I think, you know, you can say, sure, what's it to me, so what? But in fact, it is affecting you, and the kind of losses of community and communication are things that people do value. Quality of life issues are things that people value, particularly in Vancouver here. But we just haven't made the connection yet between, you know, the green movement, the environmental ecology, which is very much a priority in Vancouver for people, with that acoustic aspects are equally important and should be on that agenda.
What can you do in a community? What kinds of things to make a difference, to change things?
Everything from sometimes you have to put out some fires, sometimes you have to regulate, and there are certain things that, because we are talking hardcore politics here, but and marketplace and you know, interest groups, etc. There is a sort of an official level where communities have to be involved, but there's also, you know, grassroots levels. Like, we have a neighborhood watch program here. I'm not sure if this is familiar.
Yes.
But you also have
a neighborhood
some of
watch
these,
to keep people from burglarizing and things. That kind
whatever.
Of neighborhood
it's
watch.
For that sort of thing. But Vancouver, for instance, has a website now where they're going to try to encourage people to also input, not just a flow from the top, but to input and to identify, you know, noise issues, and then maybe also put them in touch with a local resource person that is a member of one of these Right to Quiet or some landscape or acoustic ecology groups that can help
right
them deal with
quiet.
It. That's another group in Vancouver here.
Interesting.
Right, which has a nice logo to it. So it can be very grassroots oriented. It should involve professionals, because there is a lot of technical, you know, mystification that comes, you know, in the actual measurement of sound and all that. And people tend to put their faith in experts. Oh, well, let the experts clean it up. Particularly if you utter a few, you know, PNDB.
PNDB.
That's a unit believe. believe me, that's a unit in acoustical engineering, right? And I know what it is, and I can teach a senior undergraduate. I can teach a senior undergraduate what it is in one semester. But let's face it, that's what the experts are talking about. You know, particularly with aircraft noise. Mm-hmm. And if you are going to fight it, you are going to have to deal with that kind of terminology and the thinking that goes with it. It can be understood, but it's more than that. You have to know the rational part, but you also will be more motivated if you're personally involved. If you really are listening and value sound, then you'll know what you want, and don't leave it to the experts.
It's not just a matter of fighting it. It sounds as if what you're saying is displacing it with something. I mean, you're not advocating silence. I think you're advocating is not
balance.
Noise, but
balance.
Well, and silence that is somehow or other environmentally, ecologically appropriate.
Yes. Yes. Within the acoustic environment.
Yeah. Acoustic ecology is probably could be defined as the study of the relationship of people to their sound environments. And if that relation is balanced, in other words, there's a two-way flow. You can just, again, come back to the human scale. It's listening and sound making. It's two ways.
Listening and sound making.
It's the input and the output, the impression and the expression. And if those are in balance, and it can be easily thrown off Muzak and other things, usually people say, oh, I don't like the style. But it also is silencing people. Mm-hmm. It's putting sound in where you're not encouraged to speak. You're not encouraged to make music because you're not as good as the professionals as well. But that's another matter. Anything that is silencing people, whether it's noise or music or creating an imbalanced situation, then that is the hallmark for understanding what is a balanced acoustic situation.
I must say I'm sitting here with about 1,000 new ideas popping. We're going to be back in just a moment. We're with Barry Truex. We are in Vancouver, British Columbia. Bill Russell's here. I'm Paula Gordon, and I hope you'll stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. We are with Barry Truex, Bill Russell, and I sitting here in Vancouver, British Columbia. Barry, I am very much reminded of a conversation I had with a world-class musician some programs back, and he said, you must remember that the point of music is to appreciate the silences, and that much of what we have done in the modern world is to eliminate the silences, and what chance do we have to appreciate music if the silences are no longer available?
That's right.
And as I was thinking about the work that you do, both as a musician and as a person who thinks about sound, I was having trouble sort of melding the two ideas of the silence embedded in music and what you're saying about listening,
yes,
which is a not imperialistic activity. Don't we have a lot of work to do here?
Yes. Regaining a positive sense of silence as opposed to the embarrassed, the awkward silence.
And this, I think, is a new concept to most people, that silence is bad.
Or awkward, or a communication hang-up. Yes, absolutely. And regaining the positive aspects, the healing aspects of it. We could
say
learn
more
a lot
about that,
from
the healing aspects of it?
Well, for instance, the Quakers have a wonderful 2 minutes of silence before a meeting.
Which would just drive most people crazy.
Or an entirely silent meeting. But if you do that, if any organization, particularly if you suspect there's going to be some tension and people are going to react in a kind of, you know, instantaneous gut level way and hot off the collar, whatever, there's going to be some tension. There. Have them be silent for 2 minutes. Then they will start to think a little bit more about, okay, so there's just one kind of crisis situation.
Uh-huh.
But silence is, for instance, silence is one way in which, for instance, the Quakers who practice it, it's very egalitarian. Everyone is on an equal footing in that. And it's a kind of communication. Otherwise, communication is I can dominate this conversation. Mm-hmm. You can dominate it. You can persuade. But if it's, again, balanced, then there will be a free flow back and forth. But often with the media and everything else, we fill up the time and there is no silence. I mean, why is silence such dead air on radio? It's not just lost money, but it's also the loss of control. Someone could step in. They could start taking charge. They could change the station, heaven forbid, et cetera, et cetera. And yet sound, as you've said, is only defined by silence. If you don't have silence, then you won't have sound.
We frequently recommend to our corporate clients that they find time in their day to sit quietly.
Absolutely.
Not think.
Absolutely.
Just sit quietly.
Well, yeah. There are whole traditions on the planet that are built on sitting quietly and waiting for answers to come rather than aggressively after them and talking about it.
And, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint, we had a conversation a year ago with Chris Langdon, who does artificial life, and we talked a little bit, I guess, prior to that about the need to relax a system. Mm-hmm. You know, if you drive it, it's, you know, ultimately it sort of goes over the edge.
That's
and
right.
Now again, you've got to relax it. And certainly, I think what you're describing, you know, the silence is one way to relax it.
That's right.
And even beyond that, I think what put words in your mouth, alternate, you know, a full, healthy, if you will, ecology is a way of doing that, simply by not heading down one path blindly. That the variety, in a balanced variety.
That's right. A balanced variety is exactly. In fact, those are actually the terms that we use to describe the acoustic community. That it had a lot of variety, and a lot of meaning that the inhabitants knew absolutely what every little sound and nuance of sound meant, but it was all balanced. And unfortunately, if anything that corrupts the balance, see, this is where people think, well, oh, you're just advocating the impossibility of a silent environment, and how boring that would be. Of course, no, but we were talking about the therapeutic aspects in the sense of the rhythm. If you have stress and energy, it should be balanced by silence and contemplation in a balanced sense. Every rhythm has its peaks and its valleys, its cadences and its high points. But when you start talking about the way in which sound functions, yes, it's active and it's alive, and there the question of balance is very important to ensure the fact that the communication link is open.
When I think of silence, I think of being a youngster living next to a cattail marsh, and the silence was full of the trills of red-winged blackbirds.
Yes.
Well, silence must be relative, isn't it?
It is, of course, and it's an impossibility. That's why it's such a powerful metaphor, because as soon as there's human activity, John Cage's famous story about going to an anechoic chamber where there's no reflected sound, right, and it's rather disorienting because we're not getting sound back from our environment, the reflection of all our walls and ceiling and outdoors and that. But even there, he heard his heartbeat and his neurological system, right? A high sound and a low sound. So he concluded that silence was impossible. It is part of being human. For a living entity, yes.
The richness that we deny ourselves of, forgive my dangling preposition, but the richness that goes away when we are not respectful of the soundscape is, I don't think about it. But that's your life work, isn't it?
It absolutely is, because I have some sensitivity in that area, and it's also an extremely important part of my creative life, is dealing with sound, not just music in the traditional sense, but sound and integrating it into it, and falling in love with sound, etc., the seductive aspects of it, the communicational, the nuances. Yes, everything for me is based on sound, and when I see the disasters from hearing loss to tension, nervous tension, and not to mention the loss of communicational community life, let's just say.
Community, indeed.
Because we know more about what's going on, you know, in Chechnya or Saudi Arabia than we do what's going on across the street. You know, like there's those aspects of it.
Because we're listening to the television and not our neighbors.
We know more than we know about what's going on in our own minds, I think. And again, it's that sound and that constant bombardment. Yes. I've heard people say not want to be left alone with our own thoughts.
That's right.
It might not be pretty.
Because even you're thinking of silence as the external silence, but the internal silence is almost impossible to achieve without certain practices. It's the noise in the mind that keeps on going. You may be silent, but your mind is going clickety-click forever and ever, and that's not true silence either.
Right. And that takes enormous discipline. Yes,
it does.
Yeah, I want to get to the compositions you're doing, but we talk a lot about complexity and complex systems with many of the people we deal with
from lots of perspectives.
And I was struck by some of the things you have written, talking about the current state of the art that treats sounds is essentially a linear function. You know, from a study standpoint, from an academic standpoint, from a professional standpoint, from an expert standpoint, and also, you know, period paragraph, the importance of context.
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about that.
Environmental sounds, of course, unlike perhaps language and music, which we think mean something in themselves, the context is inseparable from the meaning of environmental sounds. Because, you know, you take any example, any environmental sound, a bell or a siren or anything else, and it will mean something very rich in the community, and outside of the community, you may interpret it totally differently. It's an interesting way of studying anthropology of various cultures, is how sound, and even some anthropologists like Steve Felt have suggested that it even forms the whole geography. In fact, it's of the community, the worldview. We lack kind of the words, but that sound is integrally related and not separable. Like we say, okay, we have sight and we have sound and we have smell and touch. But in other cultures, it's totally different in their worldview. So. No, I've lost my
complexity
my
is where
complexity, but complex situations is exactly what the acoustic ecology is all about. The more you understand about acoustic behavior of vibration, it still is not adequately analyzed and synthesized by our technology. And that's one reason why the synthetic sound, even though we've got used to it and it pervades us, most music that people hear is in fact synthesized and is artificial, but it does not have the inner complexity that the acoustic world does. And that's why I constantly go back to the acoustic world. Even as a computer musician, composer for 25 years, it's the acoustic source of all of this that still is the norm that we need to, where I find inspiration.
We're going to be back in just a moment to let you talk about being a composer, because that is the most important part of your self-definition by your own descriptor, if I get that right. Anyway, certainly a big part. A big part?
Yes, absolutely. But I'm also a teacher and a commentator.
Okay, you're a complex guy.
He's a very complex person. He's not one-dimensional.
I do want to hear about the electroacoustic composer part of you, because I think that informs an awful lot of what you're saying.
Absolutely.
About these other ways to do the discipline. This is the Paula Gordon Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. We're in Vancouver, British Columbia with Barry Truax. And you gave us a little, I was going to say a peek. I don't know how to do that with a sound peek at the work that you are doing as a composer, which takes a surprising variety of sound sources and takes us into a new musical place. Can you, at risk of sounding rational about this, can you describe what you do?
I can describe it at different levels. Certainly, it is very sound-based, and it uses all sounds, all acoustic sounds. I have dealt with synthesized sounds in the past, but now for the last about 10 years or so, it's all been what are now called sampled sounds, digitally sampled sounds. But that just means acoustic sounds that have been transformed into what the computer can deal with. And so this is one way that I've talked about acoustic complexity, that I can now explore that with digital means as opposed to trying to synthesize the sounds. Although perhaps in the future we'll be able to replicate the complexity of the acoustic world with synthesis. I don't think we've got there yet, but that's a matter of debate with my colleagues who would like to differ. It also is a way, in terms of soundscape issues, of redressing a little bit of the imbalance with technology. Unlike the industry, I tend to come off as a technology critic, because to balance that, to say what we're losing with technology or what the trade-offs are. Basically, I think there's a give and take. The question is it a zero-sum game? Mm-hmm. Are all the pluses and the negatives, do they just cancel each other out?
And the answer is?
Well, I've thought very long and carefully about that in my book, Acoustic Communication, and I argued towards the end that I certainly felt that the net plus came at least through the technological aspects that would expand the way we think or understand the world. And for me, that's largely artistic, but there are other ways. I mean, the way we understand, for instance, our colleague Tony Schwartz back in the 1950s was starting to record outside, you know, and collected folk songs and street music from around the world. Mm-hmm. And suddenly we heard differently. We heard, it's hard to imagine in an era of instant satellite communication, but just, you know, comparing, you know, New York 19 district with, you know, a tape that he would get from Cairo or something like mm-hmm. that. It expanded, it literally did expand the awareness. And artists have traditionally been on that edge. Now I think it's probably more the advertising industry that's on that edge and the media, the mass media industry. But artists traditionally have been on that edge of trying to expand our worldviews. And
well, the story is told of Bartok, that he went out and mm-hmm. collected Hungarian folk songs and came back and changed the way he wrote music. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, sometimes it's inspiration like that and materials. I think it actually probably goes farther, although this may not be the place to argue the fine points of the musicology.
I didn't mean to do that.
In there. Well, yes, Bartok, is the example. But I can only say personally that it is totally the use of technology here has allowed me to think about sound in a completely different way because it changes the way I can hear it and the way that I can organize it.
What you're saying is, I think, representation represents the complex view. What Paula, I think, you know, and I mm-hmm. can put some words in your mouth, going out and listening to peasant music, doing a mapping mm-hmm. to classical music is one way of doing that.
And
that,
it's linear, isn't it?
It's useful, but there is a lot more. And I think what I hear you saying is, you know, that mm-hmm. is that you're working to do a much broader mapping, and a mapping that may include, you know, algorithms or transmogrifications or something.
That probably all is true. Although I think it would. People listening would not necessarily understand it unless I gave maybe a little more concrete example. For instance, in my piece Song of Songs, which deals with the beautiful Song of Solomon from the Old Testament, some of the components in that are environmental sounds, ambient sounds, birds, cicadas, and crickets, things like that, fire being lit, and the sounds of a monk singing with a monastery bell and some very traditional things like that. And then the text itself. And we normally, the text, the voice, the human voice, and the environmental sounds would seem to be, well, they're quite distinct. You know, there are the birds, and here are the voices. But with this digital technique that I've been developing called granulation, which is really just like using pixels for computer graphic image, just divide it into small little bits so that you can manipulate them better. And these little bits are called grains of sound, a little quanta, if you'd like to put a scientific ring on it, which it actually is. It is an acoustic quanta. It's the smallest thing that you can hear, actually, and you can't subdivide the oral impression. Anyway, when you have this little building block, then you can stretch the sounds in time, because time is one of the time scales is one of the important aspects of sound and communication. And I found when I stretched the voice, first of all, the speaking voice became more song-like mm-hmm. because it was slowed down and the inflections going up and down. You start hearing more of a musical quality. Stretch it a long distance, and it becomes like the environment because you can't sustain. Vocal sounds forever. They're breath related. And so when you get a long, sustained, slowly evolving sound, then that's more like the environment.
So a frequency mediated continuity, excuse me saying those words, all the way from nature.
Yes.
Through music.
Yes.
The spoken language.
Interesting, when you stretch the bird sounds, then they were a little more like our music, actually, as well.
Mm.
And then the two of them interact in those pieces. And so in the piece, the distinction between us and nature, symbolically, for me, this is perhaps the deepest level of the symbolism in that piece, is that we are not separate from nature, but that there is a continuum there. And again, it's one that is then played out in the context of the love imagery, the traditional love imagery of the Song of Solomon, in which the metaphors are always comparing the beloved to the richness of the environment. And is it about the environment, or is it about a man or woman who is the subject of one's love?
Well, and it also occupies that middle ground that is poetry,
mm-hmm. yes,
which also has a lyrical.
That's right. The lyrical aspect and also the metaphorical aspect is a sustained metaphor. And metaphors are one of the main ways in which we understand the world. Things are like something else. And as long as we categorize things and say that we're different from this and that, and that's us and that's them, I think that gets us into an awful lot of the problems, social problems that we have.
Well, it is self-limiting, at the very least.
It
could be an accurate
description. And destructive at the worst.
Well, it could be accurate, and it just means we're limited. It also, we would like to believe, is that we are not as constrained as sometimes we force ourselves to be.
Well, in general, I find when we understand similarities between ourselves and others and the environment and that we are connected, even though that can launch into a kind of wishy-washy, new agey sort of thing, I think there is something that is basically true about that, and that the ecology movement does understand. And to me, it's a regaining of complexity, that these are complex situations, multi-leveled, including the symbolic level. For me, virtual reality is not just, you know, pretending that you're in some imaginary space. It's also the world of the imaginary. The imaginary is the virtual realm for us. Symbolism, metaphor, all of these things that are very important in make us human, really. The ability to dream, the ability to create poetry and metaphor. That can now come into the music because the sounds themselves can be treated with that kind of symbolism.
And I'm reminded of something that Walter Freeman said in terms of just rhythm as being the driver, you know, it's from a physiological standpoint, being the driver of community. One of the things that got
cycles.
They got humans to be human was just, you can't make rhythm collectively without having some collective understanding.
That's right.
And he views it as a major driver, the music and dance specifically is a major driver of how it is we are human and how it is that we have societies and cultures.
But then what happens when that music then is controlled by the industry, right? When that ability to synchronize,
you're saying the Empire Strikes Back.
Well, it is basically the mass media strike back, and it started with Muzak in the pre-war era, where, yes, you could synchronize your workforce. So it can go both ways. But to regain some control where the individual does have a voice in the midst of all that, this is a big challenge. And we don't have the myths, the technology and the artists are not necessarily giving us the myths for the modern era that do tell us how to relate, how to deal with life's issues.
And that's what you're trying to do with your music.
Well, particularly in the music and now the latest phase of it, the music theater, the problem is that music has always kept itself very abstract. And in the art world, that seems to be the most important. And anything that would have the social reference would be, program music or film music or propaganda music or whatever, political music. And I'm trying to find within the sound, the movement is going simultaneously inside the sound to find its inner symbolism. Things like resonance and time stretching are the main techniques that I'm using to do that. But then relating it back outward to the context in a meaningful way. And theater is one way of doing this. The soundscape composition is the social aspect of it. Relating it to the soundscape, like a piece of mine, like Basilica, for instance, that uses the church bells from Quebec City. But the theater work then also dramatizes it. You can actually see it being acted out in front of you, that kind of symbolism.
And it also, I'm listening to you talk, we have allowed music to become a spectator sport.
Mm-hmm.
And we do not learn
without that interaction. And there's a lot of work behind the notion that engaging in the environment, participating in the environment, and I think what you're saying is, at least the theater is one more step closer to that.
Yes. Yeah. My only regret on the whole thing, I know I'm sounding very upbeat about this because I'm so excited by the possibilities, is the fact that this work is all totally marginalized in terms of the culture. That no one's making money on it, and so therefore you've never heard of it. That's basically what it comes down to.
Yes, but it has to be there before we can.
Yes.
There is a starting point, and it takes time. There is an element of patience in anything that is relatively
back
new.
Back to right here, my little high-tech cottage industry that's producing these CDs.
Precisely.
Because that's where you have to start.
Precisely.
Absolutely.
And one can only start where one is.
Well, and in fairness to the technology, this would not have been possible. What you are doing, what we're doing sitting here listening to you describe it would not have been possible.
Exactly, as long as we see the balance. But how do we assess what is the hype and what is the net gain that we're getting?
First, we must acknowledge that there is hype and net gain, and then we can look for it. We'll be back in just a moment for a closing thought from Barry Truax here in Vancouver, British Columbia, where he is a professor at Simon Fraser University. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Barry Truax, you have opened the ideas of community, of a sound ecology, of being able to stretch out boundaries and to feel and see and hear things differently. Do you just rejoice when you wake up in the morning with all of this work in front of you?
You're right. There is a lot to do. And I wish that I could do it 24 hours a day because it is very stimulating. And that's also why I like to try to communicate somehow to people the positive aspects of sound and what it has meant to me, because I think it could help. Maybe everyone's not going to be a musician or composer, God forbid, but but in their own way, maybe yes, God should permit, because it is that element, whatever it means to you. You can find music.
So I can go back to singing in the shower.
That's right. In the water that you are bathing in, or that, you can find music and composition if you
want. Well, and Mary Catherine Bateson talks
Absolutely.
About composing a life.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Uh-huh. And I had not thought about it in that context.
And
listening
blurring,
to the rain instead of just being mad that it's wet.
Blurring the distinction between art and life is fine because, which is fine with me, because we have so much marginalized that we've said there's official culture, counterculture, alternative culture, mass culture. And yet I don't think any of these are totally satisfying to people. As finding the personal voice, participating in it, and also experiencing the joy of others' creations as
mm-hmm.
well.
I want a closing thought on listening, because I think that may be the biggest challenge that most of us have, mm-hmm. and maybe the skill we've never had or have lost.
That's right. It takes time. It takes patience. It means that we have to suppress our own ego a little bit, to not always wanting to be controlling everything, saying, doing, and all that. It means being receptive and then translating that back into action. But it means the balance. It's the two-way link that we have to our environment.
It almost feels as if there's a space that we don't know exists that's mm-hmm. between outgoing and incoming, and that we could expand into that.
The free flow back and forth, inner and outer, impression and expression. It's all this kind of balance, yin and yang, if you want to use the wisdom of other cultures to express these eternal truths. But there, it has to be that balance. We should realize by now, as soon as we regard ourselves as separate, male and female, people and environment and all that, that it just leads to the worst kind of degradation. And if we understand the interaction, there are differences. I'm not saying everything's the same. No, there are differences, but it's seeing them as a continuum of differences that listening and the acoustic orientation ultimately gives you that sense, and you experience it. It's not just a neat idea, where there's lots of neat ideas
you
out there.
You can feel it.
But you have to experience it yourself, and sound and listening is something that we are set up very much to do ourselves.
I think you have opened us to a world of beauty to which we maybe didn't have access an hour ago. I thank you, Barry Truax.
It's my pleasure.
In addition to hearing a bit of Barry Truax's Song of Songs at the beginning of our show, you also heard a little Beauty and the Beast during the show, and we gave you a taste of his Basilica at the end of our conversation. For information about ordering Barry's CDs or for the World Forum for Acoustic Ecology website, call us, email us, or fax us. Our thanks to Barry Truax for opening our ears and our minds. Next week, meet Dr. Christopher Langton, director of the Santa Fe Institute's Artificial Life Program. That's Artificial Life. Chris and his colleagues' work may just change the future for our species.
Most of the interesting phenomenology in the world cannot be understood if you just have an understanding of its bits and pieces. It depends fundamentally on those bits and pieces interacting with each other. And until we had computers, we simply couldn't address this class of problems very well at all. With computers, we can put all the pieces together and watch them behave in time and perform experiments by changing them this way and that way. So the traditional approach in science has been analysis. Computers are allowing us to add to that wonderful set of tools a whole other set of tools, which would be the equivalent of synthesis. Great. And that's really the approach that we need to understand these complex systems.
Next week, artificial life. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.